A couple weeks ago on a Sunday night, which is a disadvantage for some, we talked about a book that is about, if you will, the philosophy of things now. And one of the things about the particular book had to do with third world thinking. And I know as Americans we don't ever want to look at ourselves in third world anyway. But I think he's right that we live in a time where everything is pointed to the individual to such an extreme that it's damaging to all. It really is. We live in a society where everything's bent to one person. And people are, you know, the concept of cancel culture comes up because one person didn't like something somebody else said or how they said it. I mean, it's to such a degree that it may not be even what you have said that is looked at as wrong. It's you shouldn't be saying anything, or yes, you used the right words, but you didn't say it in the right way. And you're like, what? Okay. But that's kind of the way things are now. And I want to talk for a little bit about the offense of the cross, because I really do think that from a lot of people's viewpoints, the cross is offensive, because the cross shows we need help, and who asked us that we need help, you know? Who said there's something wrong with me? That kind of attitude seems to be conveyed in a lot of ways through how people respond to any sort of religious anything. Look over in 1 Corinthians 1, as Ronnie had read a little bit earlier in verses 18 through 25. We're going to pick it up and read through chapter 2 and verse 5, because even in the first century, people were offended by the cross. Again, the cross is a clear signification from God that we need this sacrifice. And I think for most of us, we don't want to look at ourselves in that way at all, that we need anything like this at all. We don't need help, and yet we very clearly do need help. And so in chapter 1, if you pick up with me where he says in verse 22 that the Jews are demanding signs and Greeks are seeking after wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified. It is a stumbling block to Jews who are looking for signs. And it is folly to Gentiles, who, of course, looking for wisdom, he says. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. Consider your calling, brothers. Not many of you were wise according to worldly standards. Not many were powerful. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, even things that are not, to bring to nothing things that are, so that no human being might boast in God's presence. And because of him, you're in Christ Jesus, who became to us wisdom from God, righteousness, sanctification, redemption, so that as it is written, let the one who boasts boast in the Lord. And I, when I came to you, brothers, did not come proclaiming to you the testimony of God with lofty speech and wisdom. I decided to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. And I was with you in weakness and in fear and in much trembling. And my speech and my message were not in plausible words of wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power, so that your faith might not rest in the wisdom of men, but in the power of God. I don't think we think of the power of God as being representing the cross. The cross shows weakness. How in the world would God allow himself to be put in a position where he's on the cross? That he is suffering in a way that criminals suffered. Back in the time, if you were on the cross, it was not any sort of an accidental sort of thing. I mean, you know how it is even today. The people who are in prison are all innocent. I mean, everybody claims innocence. Well, you can well imagine the same sort of thinking would be that those people would defend themselves that way. But to be to that point where Rome was executing you, this is not something that the Jews had any access to legally. They could not kill anyone. They could not execute anyone this way. The Romans could, and that's why the Jews went to them. But in doing it in this way, the Jews didn't realize they were doing what God needed, which again just shows kind of what we were talking a little bit about in our class out here this morning, that God's going to accomplish exactly the thing he wants to accomplish. It may not happen the way we think it's going to happen, but it is going to happen exactly the way he wants it to be accomplished. They put him on a tree. They crucified him. Did he deserve it? Absolutely not. Not just because he was a relatively good guy, but because he was absolutely and completely innocent. And yet he died for the sin of the world. And that's how John puts it in John 1. Behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin, in that singular, the sin of the world. The preaching of the cross, I think, as we read about it here in 1 Corinthians, the Corinthians were not the high-minded Greeks, as somebody like from Athens. But at the same time, as the Greeks didn't really seem to be thrilled with Paul, he preaches of what that to them would be offensive. God's foolishness. That Christ, as they are seeking after wisdom, would be preached as God in the flesh, crucified, dead, killed, executed. You know, you throw every word out there. This just doesn't seem to fit. And as Jesus spoke in Matthew chapter 11, have here in front of you, that Jesus talks of, in the very last phrase you see there, blessed is the one who is not offended by me, which I think you can say from the statement we can infer Jesus offends. Well, in this context, just real quick, John the Baptist is in jail, and he just wants to make sure that Jesus is who he thinks he is. He has baptized him in Matthew 3 and did so to fulfill righteousness, not because Jesus had all these sins, but to signify to John that he's the Messiah. It's exactly what God told him. And so John was baptizing until, not really until this point, but until this point, he didn't know who Jesus was. Well, now he's knowing he's the Messiah. But he wants to make sure. And so he reaches out to Jesus through messengers. And the messengers are told by Jesus, go and tell John what you hear and see. The blind receive their sight, the lame walk, lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised up, and the poor have the gospel or the good news preached to them. And blessed is the one who's not offended by me. Which I think is his way of saying, John, don't be offended by me. People were offended. Not just by this statement. Just a couple chapters from here, a few chapters from here in Matthew 15, Jesus offends the Pharisees because they're worshiping him, that is worshiping God in a way that is not what God has asked for. They've actually elevated traditions of people over God's commands. Earlier in Matthew 15, Jesus says, you're like the hypocrites Isaiah talked about. Your mouth is lip service, but your heart's far from me. And what they were doing is they were ignoring their parents. Mark tells us the word they used, the word they came up with was Corban, that any financial obligation they might have felt to their parents to help them out, they would declare the word Corban, which meant basically they didn't have to help the parents out, according to their own ideas. And Jesus says, you've set aside the commandment of God, and you do many other such things. But in Matthew 15, 12, the disciples come to Jesus after the whole thing and say, do you not know? The Pharisees were offended when they heard this thing. Now, I know this doesn't fit exactly in the way we think of things today, but it does fit close enough. I mean, they were offended. They were offended that they're trying. Why didn't God commend them for trying? Well, because they had usurped God's commandment with their own version of something they just kind of made up. The whole thing had to do with washing of hands. You know, your disciples don't wash hands before they participate in all this. And Jesus says, well, what about you? You don't take care of your parents. God commanded this. You've come up with this. You're hypocrites. Do you not know you offended them? Well, when he heard that, his answer was, every plant that my heavenly Father has not planted is going to be rooted up. Let them alone. They are blind guides. And if the blind lead the blind, both fall into the pit. You notice his first answer to what you said offended them is, then let them be offended. Every plant my Father has not planted will be uprooted. I know we don't really think about this because I don't know how many of us grow gardens. I'm sure some of you do involve yourself with that. I can kill anything. I can tell you that. I had a grandfather who had a green thumb, could grow anything, loved doing it, was entertained by it. His house was filled with plants. They had a greenhouse out in the front. You had to climb through the jungle to get into the house. I mean, it was something like that. He had a garden out in the back that, you know, he grew jalapenos, which I actually did enjoy harvesting those because put one in your mouth, one in the basket, two in your mouth, one in the basket. You know, you come in with five of the jalapenos. What happened? You had a whole row. Yeah, they're in our stomachs now. We've been eating them. I mean, they were good. All that to say, I didn't inherit any of that ability at all. But in Matthew 13, I think Jesus illustrates the whole thing about planting. Let's say you have your garden, as you're turning over to Matthew 13, and you have your garden and you're growing in it, you know, jalapenos. You do that because you like them. And someone else comes in and plants broccoli, which I'm using myself as the illustration. I'm not real keen on broccoli. Broccoli's good enough, I guess. You're supposed to eat it, right? As Seinfeld, you've got Newman who calls it a vile weed. I'm right along there with him on that. But you can imagine that what you planted in your garden isn't what you harvest. How upset would you be? Well, this is exactly Matthew 13. And again, the connection I'm wanting to make is, don't be offended by Jesus, he says. There are those who are offended, and Jesus says, let them be offended. Every plant that has not been planted by my Father is going to be uprooted. Matthew 13, 24 is where he tells this parable. He put another parable before him, and he said, the kingdom of heaven may be compared to a man who sowed good seed in his field. But while his men were sleeping, his enemy came in and sowed weeds among the wheat. Now, if you have any other word there, it might be tares. And the idea is a tare and a grain of wheat, as it, you know, as wheat grows and tares grow early on, they look exactly the same. There's no difference. And when he talks about sowing seed, he's talking about, you know, wheat. You get wheat, you have flour, you eat bread. Well, someone has put in tares. And at first, you can't tell the difference. Which one's which? And that's the point. The enemy came in and did this. And so in verse 26, when the plants grew up and bore grain, the weeds also appeared. And the servants of the master of the house came and said to him, Master, did you not sow good seed in your field? Notice, you sowing good seed in your field. How then does it have weeds or tares? And he said to them, an enemy has done this. And so the servants said to him, then what do you want us to do? Go gather them? And he said, no, lest in gathering the tares you root up the wheat with them. Let both grow together till the harvest. And at harvest time, I'll tell the reapers, gather the weeds first and then bind them in bundles to be burned, but gather the wheat into my barn. Give it some time. At the harvest, you'll be able to tell the distinction. And how they would be able to tell is wheat grew pretty tall, and the tares didn't. But again, initially, the tares and the wheat kind of grow up at the same dimension. Within a foot or two, they're looking the same. And after a while, wheat, you can tell very clearly, is wheat. The tares are real thin and just not but a couple feet tall. Now we're going to pick it up, as I have here in verse 36, where he leaves the crowds and the disciples say, look, can you explain this to us? He left the crowds, went into the house, and his disciples came saying, explain to us the parable of the weeds of the field. And notice, it's not all of them, just this one. And he answered, the one who sows the good seed is the Son of Man, which would be himself. The field, notice this, is the world. And the good seed is the sons of the kingdom. The weeds are the sons of the evil one. And the enemy who sowed them is the devil. Notice he doesn't banter about or try to make it even more confusing. He's just very clear. These are these things and this is that. And he who does that is this, right? Very clear. Again, verse 39, the enemy who sowed them is the devil. The harvest is the end of the age. The reapers are angels. And just as the weeds are gathered and burned with fire, so it will be at the end of the age. The Son of Man will send his angels. They'll gather out of his kingdom all causes of sin and all lawbreakers and throw them into the fiery furnace. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Then the righteous will shine like the sun in the kingdom of their Father. He who has ears, let him hear. Now this is what Jesus was saying there as we were reading just earlier there in Matthew chapter 15. Every plant my Father has not planted is going to be uprooted. I know I say this often enough, let the Bible serve as its own commentary, and that's, I think, the way to do this. Matthew 15, again, we go to Matthew 13 and understand as clearly as possible, this is what he's talking about. Someone who sows in his garden things that don't belong. The reality is there are a lot of religiously minded people who are not mindful of God. What they're mindful of is what it may do for them and how they feel about it. They have a version of God, a version of truth that they like. But if the truth comes along, and I say this because in the first century when Jesus came along, that's not what the Jews expected. The Jews had come up with this really interesting concept. It wasn't a biblical concept, but the concept they had was that there would be a few different messiahs. There would be a few different men, a warrior, there would be a high priest, there would be a king, and they would fill the gap in this way. And Jesus comes as really not even a noble person. Yes, he's related to David. The genealogy of Matthew points to David, and also, we have Abraham involved, and Luke does the same thing, but Jesus wasn't what they expected. He was, from their view, a blasphemer because he kept calling himself the Son of God, subtly and sometimes plainly. And not only that, but when he taught, he would teach things that, like we read in Matthew 15, just didn't fit their theology. And not only that, he would go off healing people. How dare he? And he did it on the worst day ever, which was the Sabbath. It's not that he healed only on the Sabbath, but there are a number of times in the gospel accounts, it's very clear he did it on the Sabbath. Mark 3 is a great passage. A man with a withered hand, and they had no sympathy for the guy. And Jesus is angry with him, and he heals this guy. They had no compassion. Jesus came in and turned things upside down, which, to be honest with you, was right side up. If you think about it, I mean, you know, I don't know how to illustrate this exactly. I've thought about it a few different ways. I know there are pieces of art. This is one of the funny things. Victor Borga was a very, very good pianist, and he was an entertainer, a very funny guy. You can look him up on YouTube. He's hilarious. There's this one thing I remember. He's sitting there plucking along on a piano. It sounds, you know, weird, but it's good music. And then he stops and he goes, and he turns it. It's like a piece of paper like this. And he has it upside down, and then he puts it this way, and he goes, ah, much better. And he plays it, and it's the same music. Just funny. But I think sometimes that's what it is. The law, we think is something because we've heard it traditionally one way. Jesus came in and said, you've heard that it was said to those of old, but I say to you. That's in the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew 5, over and again, he says, you've heard that it was said, you shall hate your enemy. I'm telling you, pray for your enemy. Love your enemy. You know, they heard all kinds of things. It's okay to look at a woman and lust for her. He says, I'm telling you, you do that, you're committing adultery with her in your heart. So what Jesus does is he comes in and he turns it straight. He makes it the way it should have been understood. Does that mean everyone's going to understand it? No. Does it mean everyone's going to want that? No. Jesus said, you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. Well, there are a couple other passages, like 2 Corinthians 3:4, where Paul says, even if our gospel is veiled. You notice he's not saying, well, we need to unveil it. He says, even if our gospel is veiled, it's veiled to those who are perishing. What does Jesus say? Do not cast your pearl before swine. If your gospel is veiled, or if the gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing. In their case, the God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelievers. It's not God doing it, it's Satan doing it. To keep them from seeing the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who's the image of God. Satan has done this. In the parables, Jesus says, the sower goes out and sows good seed. The birds of the air come and take it away. That meant Satan, who comes and takes away the word, lest they should hear it and believe it, or hear it and understand it. In another passage, Paul in 2 Thessalonians 2:9-12 says that the presence of the lawless one, as Paul's explaining all this to the Thessalonians, is by the activity of Satan, with all power, false signs, wonders, with all wicked deception for those who are perishing because they refuse to love the truth and be saved. Therefore, God sends them a strong delusion so that they may believe what's false, in order that all would be condemned who did not believe the truth, but had pleasure in unrighteousness. I know we've been kind of saying this in different ways for the last few weeks, but this is the time we live in because it's the time they lived in. This is mankind. We want a version of truth that's palatable. We want to hear things the way we'd like to hear things. We want truth to be what we want it to be. And you can turn to Romans 1 and consider what Paul says, that because they exchanged the truth of God for the lie and worshiped and served the creature rather than the Creator, God gave them up. Three times, Paul says, God gave them up, and things get worse and worse. I know you and I as Christians, we're kind of looking at a society going, this place, this world just seems to have lost its mind. Yeah, I think it goes in a cycle of some kind. That's just my opinion about it. But the bottom line is, this is not new stuff. In Rome, in Romans 1, Paul was saying, this is the world we're living in, right here, right now. It's not always been that way, but now it might be we're feeling that way too. It's happened before. My point is this. There are people who can look the truth in the eye and they don't agree with it. I mean, just plainly. Just don't agree with it. Jesus said, you shall know the truth. Pilate asks, what is truth? Because he was a worldly-minded person. He wasn't going to get it, and that's what Paul is talking about. They do not have a love for the truth, therefore they will not get it. They won't get it. If you've ever had an opportunity in studying with somebody, and you're like, this is what it says, and they're like arguing with you, well, you said this. No, actually, God says that. And then they're upset with what God has said. They just don't want that. It's Ogden Nash who said, I'd rather have my facts all wrong than have no facts whatever. He was a New York poet, one of my favorites, because he would make words up to rhyme on purpose. But that's the world we live in. I'd rather have my facts all messed up, confused, than to have no facts at all. You say this, I say that, we're saying the same thing. No, we're not, because of what God is revealing to us. The cross, again, is offensive. Ephesians 4, 17 through 19, Paul wrote, you must no longer walk as the Gentiles do, in the futility of their minds. They're darkened in their understanding, alienated from the life of God. And notice, it is because of the ignorance that is in them due to the hardness of their heart. They don't get it because they don't want to get it. I never had this line of thought come through my brain in high school, but I guess I could try it now. You know, I did really poorly in chemistry. I did well in the first year and thought, oh, I'll try the second year. And then really had lost my brain in third year. I had a third year of chem. And I remember going into a test thinking, man, I got this one down, and came back with a big solid F. I mean, it was failure. And my teacher was funny. He was like, it's like you don't know any of this at all. Wow, okay. He was right, absolutely right. But, you know, the argument today would be, well, maybe you don't think it's right, but I do. I know enough about chemistry to say there are certain things you do and do not mix, right? We all know H2O, hydrogen, two parts, oxygen, one part. You got water, it works. There's some things you don't mix because they are explosive, they're unstable. Not just because you think so or don't think so, it's because that's just the way they are. And that's what we need to understand. There are moral laws you can't change. It doesn't matter what legislation says. It doesn't matter how many people vote on something to be so. Sin, still, from the view of our Creator, is sin. And we must not be like the Gentiles around us in the futility of their minds, living their lives, darkened in their understanding, alienated from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them. Again, he says, because of the hardness of their heart. Because of that, they've become callous. They've given themselves up to sensuality, greedy to practice every kind of impurity. Does that not sound like our day and time? Greedy to practice every kind of impurity? We might say yes, first century. That's what they were doing then. Again, I'm not just trying to say what goes around comes around, and I'm not just trying to say 21st century is like the first century, although that's part of it, but to understand mankind's condition hasn't changed. In the first century, they didn't have their smartphones. They had to figure things out in their brain with math. Can you imagine living in a time like that? Can you imagine living in a time with no air conditioning, roads, and so on and so forth? We think of all of the modern conveniences we really do enjoy and love. Has it brought us closer to God? No. I think more so it's pushed us further away. But apparently, even when they had nothing like that, they were far away because of the hardness of their heart. We don't want typically to be told what to do and what to think. And yet God, our Creator, tells us what to do and what to think. And if we don't like that, it's not that we're going to have a version of heaven all on our own. Because God's view is his home in heaven or hell, away from him in his presence forever. If God stopped all sin, and we've talked about this, we're not going to read these passages, but these are two examples, one from the Old, one from the New Testament, where God dealt with sin right there and then. Nadab and Abihu in Leviticus 10, they offer profane fire that he had not commanded, and he killed them right there and then. Stopped it. Acts 5 is Ananias and Sapphira, who lied to God, and God didn't let them continue in it. He stopped it. These are just two simple examples of people that God stopped dead in their tracks, literally stopped dead. They can't sin anymore. If God dealt with all sin this way, and there are people who say, well, if there was a God, he would just stop it all. All right, that's what he did to Nadab and Abihu and with Ananias and Sapphira. Would any of us be here? And we know the answer is no, if that's what he did. Thank God he doesn't do that. And he's merciful and gracious. They are good examples. Examples like in Acts 5, you read that the church scared. I don't know about you, that would make all of us straighten up really quick, wouldn't it? I mean, it would. You'd think it would. Here's the point I want to make with that. Even though we may not, like Ananias and Sapphira, Nadab and Abihu, meet our end right there and then, we are all going to stand before God in judgment. And it's either going to be a great day or it's going to be a really bad day. And I say that because eternity is described as just a never ending. It's beyond us to comprehend. I've read all kinds of different things. Some of them I think, yeah, that's kind of a good idea, but it's just the eternal now. I know right now we're all thinking about lunch and our plans for this afternoon, plans for this evening. You may even have already been thinking about what you're doing tomorrow. Monday comes, right? And maybe your calendar and your brain goes to, well, what's coming up in March, what's coming up in April. I mean, you know, we start thinking that way and we just go. Eternity is not described as any sort of calendar clock thing. It's just an eternal now. Can you imagine being in heaven where there's no reason to have an afternoon siesta, there's no reason to think about tomorrow because there isn't one? How glorious and wonderful that would be. You've ever had moments in your life you thought, I hope this never ends. Yes. The opposite is hell. And all you want it to do is end. It's not just because it's dark and scary. I watched a movie last night. I do not want to. I actually had to fast forward through a lot of it. I don't know what your fears are. Mine, honestly, are two things, basically, spiders and drowning. So drowning in spiders, the worst thing ever. The movie I was watching last night had to do with drowning. And I actually had to forward through it all. Even though I knew this whole thing was all made up and everything, I was like, that was freaking me out. Can you imagine, though, being in a scary place that just never stops being just, not just scary, but painful? To have an immortal body that never dies or never decays, where Jesus said in Matthew 9, their worm does not die. I know the world would like to think, you know what hell is? Hell's where the party's at. Hell's where Satan's throwing the biggest, best party ever, and it's where the fun people are. No, hell is described as a place where every vile and evil person is punished forever and ever. The fire doesn't go out. The worm doesn't stop. Those immortal bodies that were designed for eternity in heaven are being consumed forever. Darkness. It's hard for us to imagine either heaven or hell, I think. It really is. I don't want to have to imagine heaven. I want it to be a reality, and I don't ever want to get near hell. But we all, every one of us, is going to stand before God in judgment. It is written, as I live, says the Lord, every knee will bow to me. And I know there are people who say, oh, you know, atheists, people who just don't believe in God at all. I won't be me. Yes, everyone. Every tongue will confess to God. So then each of us is going to give an account to himself to God. And finally, Matthew 10. What we were talking about earlier about being offended by Jesus. Jesus said, blessed is the one who is not offended by me. Every plant that my Father has not planted is going to be uprooted. All that, I think we could summarize in some way in Matthew 10, 28 through 33, where there Jesus says, do not fear those who kill the body and after that cannot do anything. I'll read the text here because I conflate sometimes what Luke has with Matthew. Do not fear those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul. Rather, fear him who can destroy both soul and body in hell. Are not two sparrows sold for a penny? Not one of them will fall to the ground apart from your Father. But even the hairs of your head are all numbered. Fear not, therefore, you are of more value than many sparrows. So everyone who acknowledges me before men, I'll also acknowledge before my Father who is in heaven. But whoever denies me before men, I will also deny before my Father who is in heaven. I don't know about you. That it's not just the humiliation of that. I mean, have you ever been in a situation where you're like, hey, I know this person, and you come up and you say, hey, it's me, and they look at you and they're like, I don't know you. Never met you. And you know they know you. Right? If you've not had that experience, it's humiliating. Everybody around you is like, you're an idiot to think, yeah, you know this guy. But this is more than that. This is not just humiliation to stand before God and him say, I don't know you. In other contexts, he says, depart from me, workers of iniquity. I never knew you. That's what we're talking about. That's the scary. And I don't want to be there. I want to be the one who acknowledges God before men. Because that way, he says, I'll acknowledge you before my Father who's in heaven. If we deny him in our works, we deny him with our mouth. If we deny him, he's going to deny us. This morning, if you're not a Christian, you can, this moment, acknowledge him and do so in front of others who have done that also, who have that confidence of hope. Not perfected in that way of we're now perfect, but perfected in the way that God, through his Son, has justified us in the blood of his Son, and we enjoy that benefit and the eternal hope set before us. You can have that too. Why keep Jesus waiting? Come forward right now as we stand and sing together.